that above the clouds on any given rainy, horrible day, there's one sun shining. Beyond the lens of the prism or the kaleidoscope, beyond the array of colors, a blending of colors, there's one light, inclusive, combining, radiating all the others. And so too, above and beyond the infinite forms of manifestation, and above and beyond even self-consciousness, is oneness of beingness, the absolute spirit, ever unfolding, ever becoming, ever reincarnating once the human state is achieved. Now, so too, our consideration for this morning is beyond compassion and the personal applications and the self-centered thinking. There is one power of perception, one power for love and devotion. It is applied in a caring way, but it radiates from the true nature of self, both at the cosmic level and at the individual human level, and is often reminded for us in this statement or the notion that look within, thou art Buddha. And so the heart doctrine is based on that power, is a reflection in a certain way of that power. And there are many different readings or sources that you can look into for yourself in the philosophy to explore the notion of the heart doctrine. There's a collection of articles by William Q. Judge. There are the writings of B.P. Wadia in various formats. And there are also, if you will, the comments of The Voice of the Silence, a devotional book that in this arena of the heart doctrine offers some do-it-yourself tips and techniques. Now, there are actually duality in the manifestation of this doctrine. There's a head doctrine that's mentioned in many sources, as well as the heart doctrine. That head doctrine is an open path, familiar to us all, and is actually a very common starting point for any seeker of truth who's trying to understand religion, philosophy, science, ethics. It's a starting point for many. The head doctrine refers to that representation of power in the human state that has to do with mind and thinking at an intellectual level. It's logical. It is an observant of the external environment, the outside. There is reasoning from premise to conclusion. And frequently, the head doctrine can be seen as Aristotelian, looking at the many trying to come up with the one fundamental principle, if you will. That's an open path, common to all. But the heart doctrine is said to be closed or secret in many sources, not Aristotelian, probably more akin to a Platonic use of power. It can be seen as a full bloom of power resting and potential in the human state of consciousness. It's more aligned with direct cognition, with soul wisdom, with intuition, contemplation, meditation, heeding the voice of conscience, that voice of the silence within each and all. And so if we're thinking, again, in analogies, and we're thinking about the type of thinking that might be done under the head doctrine, we might think of law and order, in the court systems. Literal word decoding, reading that is extremely finite and particular. If we're thinking of the heart doctrine applied in a court of law, we think more of justice, the spirit of the law, the interpretation and of nuance and application of a principle to a particular, an inner meaning of all of that. Esoterically, from ancient China, from ancient India, the heart doctrine is said to be soul wisdom. It is a teaching that goes back more than 5,000 years, but certainly to the teachings of Gautama the Buddha. It is based on the embodiment of the permanent and everlasting soul wisdom, as it can be expressed in the conditions according to karma and reincarnation. It is said to be divine wisdom, theosophy, if you will, true power. And as was previously asserted, if we think about the little poetry book, Voice of the Silence, we have a variety of different do-it-yourself advice about how to develop the heart wisdom needed to live this internal path of meditation and calm, universally applied brotherhood of intention and goodwill. We are told to sow kindly deeds, kindly acts, in order to reap their fruition, in order to gain insight into spiritual wisdom, not knowledge. We're told that inaction in a deed of mercy becomes an action in a deadly sin. And we're told that self-knowledge is of loving deeds the child. So our step one would be to live for the good of all, but to live from the basis of principle, ethics, eternal divine virtues. And again, philosophically, this would be potential, powerful, and possible because all soul moving through the human state is from that one deific source, that one source of beingness of each and all. So our second consideration, if this is the universality of power, and if heart doctrine is the true path, how in the world does that pertain to human relationships in today's life and times?
Well, what is our problem? Why is not our heart fully opened? Why do we not feel as we are one with humanity? Well, because we have a knot in our heart. And it's, as we stated from the very beginning, what is that knot? It's that personal idea that separates us from everything else. That's why, as it was stated at the beginning of this conversation, that we try to keep an impersonal attitude. But we need to take that all the time. If we want to untie that knot in the heart, we have to look at life in a much wider and broader perspective. And that has to be through the unattachment of our personal idea. The Gita says, do what is before you. Do it with joy and happiness. And don't take any personal credit for it. But do it. Do it freely. And dedicate it to all of life. Give it away. Give it back. Be selfless. Well, that seems like a gigantic step for mankind. But it is a possibility. The possibility lies in what we identify with. What do we identify with? If we identify with the body, all these troubles exist. We see growing up amongst us gossip, carrying of tales to one person to another, finding fault, and we become adept at that. And what is good? No, it's what is bad. Our attitude is really facing in the wrong direction. The heart is filled with hope. And if we want to share in that heart energy, we need to be positive. Positive that this life is meaningful. Positive that I am a ray of that light. That everyone that I meet and everything that I see has a ray of that light. So I am identifying with all of life. We can only hold that idea perhaps for a moment, for maybe a little bit longer, but we're distracted by our senses. That's why we're asked to, if we would like to proceed upon this path, is take control of one's senses. Do not become a slave to the senses. And it said, the wish to know is almost solely intellectual, but the desire to be is of the heart. Be kind, be charitable, and throw no stones. You know, do we understand what gratitude is in our conversations with other people? That, you know, if someone does not do a good as job as we think they should or could, we're just showing our impatience. And patience is a virtue. We've read that patience is as needful as silence. So the personal element is our battle. And to overcome that, we have to become devoted. But how, if our devotion has to be of a universal perspective, but a very personal idea. So how do we really benefit mankind? We're always asked as theosophists, you know, what are you doing? What are you doing to help mankind? Well, we have to become devoted to humanity in the broadest sense. And how do we devote ourselves to humanity? We have to have faith in masters, which therefore in the higher self. And then when we gather a comprehension of the fundamentals of this philosophy, of theosophy, and we gather about a sincere attempt to present these truths to a people who are in desperate need of them, when we think that humanity is in desperate need, this is the root of all the problems. So in our modern world, we're driven. We're driven by ambition. We're driven by power. And it seems to be the underlying force for our existence. If that underlying power and ambition is not focused into altruistic work, we lose our way. That we only have really one path. We think we are making a choice, but it is our destiny. So why are we fighting against it? Why aren't we not just giving in to that higher impulse? Well, the personal element. The personal element. We are all of us selfish. We endeavor daily to become unselfish, to be unselfish, and then aspire to being selfless. And that's without any personal attachment to what we do. So, it really comes down to how we feel about everyone that we meet. What goes through our mind when we see them, when we talk to them, or when we're at home by ourselves and reflecting. What ties us together? It's our heart. It's not our intellect. It's our common bond of humanity. It's our feeling nature. So what we do is we try to separate ourselves from one another through criticism, through finding fault, or by looking at things from above and down. So sometimes inferring that place of a superior attitude. Personal idea is very cunning. Very cunning. But we come and we have to confront it, usually in times of great sorrow and great trouble and a great test in our life. And where do we always retreat? To our heart, because that is the only place where we are going to find comfort. And that's why we all share in sorrow, because we all can identify with it, not intellectually, but in our heart. We all have mothers. We all have fathers. We all have grandparents. We all have that connection to this material plane. So here we are, working through matter and trying to raise it up. No, that's done through the heart, through being kind, to being charitable, and throwing those stones. Now we know we have many shortcomings as people, as friends, and we just need to consider why this is so. There are many sayings and ideas that bring us back, keeps on bringing us back. Like our real life is not in words of love or hate or coldness, but in the fiery depths of the heart. Cast no one out of your heart. But beware, our heart moving too rapidly will destroy the life. The first step in true magic is devotion to the interest of others. Near to renunciation is salvation. And enlightenment of the one self is for the good of others. These are just words that turn our attention to the reality. We think what we see is the reality, but so we are deceived. And we know we are deceived. That's why we're asked, take that time each day to reflect, to identify with that unchanging consciousness that we befriend. We become aware of, truly as we grow older, we know that there's something about us that hasn't changed, because we have the feelings of being young, but the body can't follow it. But the feeling wells up within us. But our expression of it is being transmuted. That's what old age or age does. We learn what the real expression of our feelings are. So we are told that the royal talisman of every student is our duty and selflessness. That's the royal talisman. Again, something we place before us, as the idea was expressed, as we keep within our consciousness that this higher self is a master, is that perfectibility, is that perfected being. That is our higher self. And that higher self is with us. Just have to untie that knot in the heart. The simplest of things we are asked to do, which are the hardest. Give up the self for the self. The heart is our binding force with all of nature. For every other kingdom below us, we cannot communicate to them through our intellect, for theirs is not developed. But we have an electromagnetic pulsating entity that communicates with all of life. Because all of life has that impulse of life within it. And we are able to identify the vibrations, the beating of that life. And so that's why we were asked, be kind, be charitable, live for others. That's the only way we will advance. We don't want to seem like this is something that we're just sort of like not lecturing, but trying to give back. So having received these ideas, we need to freely give them away. And we try to do that 3 times a week, give these ideas away. And we do that as a theosophist in the true expression of universal brotherhood. So we'll open it up for questions and hope these few ideas sparked some conversation, if not with each other, within ourselves. What is real? So that's why it's so good to see everyone and to know that everyone is still on this plane. We're still trying to fight and use these ideas.
CBW. Yes, we heard. And the first thing that came to my mind, we have to have a symbol, an object that we are familiar with, and use it as a guide. And we thought of a balance, a scale. 2 pans, arm connecting those 2 pans, resting on 1 point, and that resting on a pedestal or base. Now we know we can touch the pan and they swing back and forwards. But once we talk about one particular idea, and that's in the pan, then we have the opportunity of balancing the scale so that we have some symbolized idea that everyone can understand. And we begin to use that balance. Could you explain from that point of view the scale, what goes in the pans, how does it operate, and the meaning of harmony in our understanding based against our actions? Hello?
Well, you've accomplished a great deed. You have made us think. I see SL has a hand up.
I think that in a way, the balance is between the intellectual understanding and the heartfelt application. So we need to think with the heart and feel with the mind. That too much on either side can throw us off balance. So every teaching that we try to understand with our mind. We can only assimilate it and make it applicable in our life if we feel its truth and apply it from the perspective of the heart.
And that's called the heart doctrine. The heart doctrine.
TK. Sound.
Unmute.
So then it would seem the converse of that might be true too. Every application of the heart doctrine in the context of human relationship must be tempered with a certain level of common sense, a certain level of intellect, because we are mind beings, and if we want to effectively communicate that, so it's almost like it's got to be on in both ways, through both heart and mind.
And key would be if universal brotherhood and compassion and loving all others as they are, as they present themselves, regardless of conditions, if we're thinking from that premise, then we do raise cold logic, cold intellectualism to a lighter, loftier spiritual point. But again, the balance has to be there. Neutrality, yoga of thinking and action as a creative force in the world.
Well, we see something happening when someone close to us dies, a mother, a father, a brother, sister, that there's a feeling of great loss, and we feel that something has gone, that there is a link has been broken. And what we come to realize is that the beating of that heart has left this plane, but it's gone on to another plane. And once we realize that, there is no loss. There is no separation. The body is separated, but our connection is not. You know, we fail to realize that this connection we have with a mother and father must be very strong, because they were the entities that brought us into this world. So what is that connection? Where is the connection with our mother and father? It's in our heart. So there's that constant interchange of energy we have with each other. You know, we can say something, but we feel, you know, we feel who they are. We just find great joy in people who are honest and kind. Do no harm. So that we can be ourselves with each other and be safe.
And key also is to follow karma, follow the wheel of life, fulfill our duties to race, to kin, to friend, and to foe. So even if we perceive that another, some other human, is not really tuned into kindness and compassion and virtue, the effort to the endeavor, the strong endeavor to remain centered and to deal with them as soul above those limitations and conditions remains a big challenge. LT, your hand was up, and then SL's hand was up. No? Okay. SL?
in the voice of the silence, it says that great sifter is the heart doctrine. And we were wondering, how do we understand that from either the perspective of the first panelist, which looked at it from the larger perspective of going from universals particulars, or from the second perspective, which looked at it in terms of human relationships? What does it mean, great sifter is the heart doctrine?
Well, in our readings, the great sifter is often referred to as karma, isn't it? Karma as a compassionate law. And from the universal point of view, we have all sorts of scripture and hints that say that desire first arose in it. It being the beingness that emerges, that is emanating in and from the absolute. So that desire is compassion. It is the great sifter. It is the great mediator or energy in all of evolution on the spiritual, moral, ethical, psychic, all levels of planes, and is definitely the moving a balance between discerning cold intellect and spiritual heart. Anyone else have a different view? LG?
Well, definitely not a different view, but maybe another way of putting it that helps us is that when our desire is to do the right thing at the right time to the right person in the right way, we take all the energy of our intellect and we sift through it very carefully, trying to find that one thing that will be of benefit in every situation. And when we have that heart's desire to do something helpful or useful, that's when we can sift through the what is exists within the intellect, within the mind.
Thank you. LT?
Bam, there we go. So the one thing that came to mind that speaks to me, to the heart, is living the life by Wadia, Divine Ethics and Brotherhood, Universal Brotherhood. That is by far one of my favorite articles. And it just brings truth. I did want to talk about the idea of selfishness. And I've had a conversation with a couple of my friends about this, and realizing is that it's limitless, or it's limiting in the sense that when you act selfless, you actually have more than what's provided, and that there is infinite when it's shared in a common sense of a universal brotherhood. So giving and having the sense of selfishness is actually more limiting to that individual. And it comes to a point that in that mentality, when you really do desire something, you don't have it. And that limiting mentality is what you lack in. And that's in opposite, you know, we have somebody that is giving and there is just infinite amount of everything out there for them. So that's something that I wanted to bring to light. Thank you.
The comment also brings to mind the earlier statement that, you know, it's the knots of our heart that have us all twisted up and limited and conditioned. And so too with the opening, we can use the image of a hand. If it's balled up into a fist to grasp or to fight, or to hold on tight to something in fear, then there can be no receiving and no giving. It's not until the hand is open that and the knot of the hand is untied that we have a representation of what can happen with heartfelt imagery too.
We the idea that Mr. Wadia is very helpful to read many of his articles. But we find that if we are sometimes lost in our feelings and need someone to talk to, we have Mr. Judge. He emanates the heart doctrine. He emanates how we can be in this world. He was a lawyer, a professional. He lived in the same world that we live in. And we are given an example how we can work. So, yes, Mr. Wadi is very much the heart doctrine as well.
SL?
If the knot of the heart is selfishness, what is the knot of the intellect? What is the knot of the mind? And are the two related?
Well, we would think it's the idea of being separate.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that is that, yes. Yeah, we think we don't need to elaborate on that. Yes, LG.
Noticing about intellect, the knot there is, it seems to be that, again, going back to what we discussed Friday on the power, that those who use their intellect over others, and then those who fear that their intellect is not strong. And so there's that knot of selfishness is there. And in talking with someone who had a PhD, he said there's only one advantage to having a PhD. And he said that's everybody thinks you know everything, you know a lot. And he says, you know, you don't know anything at all. And so he shows in that example that you open up your hand and recognize that even though you may have a lot of intellectual knowledge, that the person in front of you will have something that you don't have. So you should keep your hand open and your heart open to receive what it is, the knowledge and that they have. That we don't have everything within us, no matter how smart we think we are.
LT, you got your hand up before? Sorry.
Well, one of the things we haven't yet talked about is that the process, the endeavor to become heartfelt, heart-centered, opens up all channels, all powers of perception, mind and heart, to that universal, ongoing, eternal source of soul wisdom, to what in the East is called Buddhi. So there is that notion that while the PhD may feel extremely limited, akin to the undereducated, formally educated individual, in reality, at heart, they each have equal potential and access to this soul wisdom, the eternal, divine, loving philosophy.
But we think that LG made a point that it is sort of an idea that is floating out there that many people identify with PhD or anything that sets one above someone else or separate from someone else, and that we don't consciously recognize it most of the time. And know, it just makes us, it makes us to need to be mindful of one more thing.
MJW.
Yes. The expression, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. You know, when we were young and we heard that expression, we thought that that was kind of silly. But as we've matured, it is dangerous because we just know a little bit and then we generalize, then we can really get in trouble and get... And if we're in a position of power, we can do an awful lot of damage. And with education, there's so much specialization, and we seem to not, generalist, I mean, a good generalist is a good person to have, and one who has perhaps a little bit of knowledge, but in a lot of areas, and is has an open heart and an open mind to receiving knowledge, not closing the fist, closing the mind, and negating others, because that often happens in positions of authority or just with people in general, that they negate the other person's. We think of Socrates, how he said he basically knew nothing. He was the dumbest person around, but he asked the right questions. And of course, that's what we try to do here at Theosophy Hall, don't we?
It's a to be or not to be. So how do we be? We know how we think we are, or we think we're being, but what does it mean to be? And we're saying that first principle is be-ness.
We have a chat from ZZ, and that came in before LG's hand went up. ZZ wrote to everyone, in briefly identifying with another's previously unknown disharmony, could our range of flexibility expand? So as we begin to, whoever our companion is, friend, foe, family, JD just responded on chat, yes. Whenever we identify with soul in the other, whenever we have a namaste moment where we're looking into the experience that someone else is suffering from or has suffered through, we are expanding our flexibility, aren't we? We are assimilating the effort of seeing the other's pain and suffering, identifying with the soul that's eternal as opposed to the condition, and then hopefully being alert enough, open enough, so that intuitively we know how to relieve that condition or how to share the fact that universally we are at one moving through such a thing. LG, your hand was up.
Well, I'm responding to that question, which is very good.
Yeah.
It's a question that we should carry with us into all our relationships, especially with family. So oftentimes we find such disharmony in family situations, and the question sort of brings to the reason as to why and what we can do about it. When someone's lower nature starts to vibrate and we feel our own lower nature starting to vibrate in unison with it, this question can come to mind. We have to increase our range of flexibility by unlocking our fist, by taking that vibration and overcoming it in precisely that moment. That's not easy to do, though. That comes to mind. That it's a good question. So my other thought went out of my head as I contemplated that question.
Uh-huh. Well, JD came up on chat and says that disharmony provides an opportunity to evolve your understanding. The knot of mind is the differential between perspective and reality. LT and then SL.
This is a really good question. I'm glad ZZ brought this up. This is a question that gives a yes and a no. In a recent experience, having dealt with friends that were vibrating on their lowest in nature and not taking of advice, and really at the point where they were devolving, not evolving, and having to separate yourself from that, where does theosophy come in, and how do we empower others in these kind of situations when they cannot see the higher nature in themselves, or that we cannot, or they're unable to accept a higher of the good of nature for themselves and their family?
A good question. Part of the Kuan Yin pledge says, forever and everywhere I will live and strive for the redemption of every creature throughout the world from the bonds of conditioned existence. So when an earlier speaker today was talking about sitting in meditation, or if we were thinking about trying to move through the day 24/7 from a mindful, soulful, heartful point of view, all of that energy, all of that so-called wishful thinking can supply the kind of vibration that LG just responded to. It can neutralize the vibration from the other, or it can go out into the universe and empower and affirm the other. SL, your hand was up.
Our discussion makes one thing clear, that by endeavoring to become a theosophist or study theosophist, it does not make us less sinful or less vulnerable to do the wrong thing. We might even have more faults than someone who does not call themselves a theosophist or believe in theosophical principles. But it does mean we're going to try to take the principles and make ourselves better. So the focus then is on self-examination, self-improvement, rather than judgment of others.
And JD chatted a response, living your highest nature is your strongest influence on others.
Amen. Amen.
Well, our hour is drawing to a close.
Yeah.
And, but we'd like to remind everyone that we have two other meetings, or a total of three meetings each week. And this is in an endeavor to keep these ideas before the public. All are welcome to participate in this activity. So even though we are not in the building at the moment, we have to remind each one that our sacrifice of time, service, and money is always welcomed. And we look forward to seeing everyone again. Meeting adjourned.
Meeting adjourned.